you want them to see this.
Yes. And what I just said, are they going to see that too? Okay, well, you guys got the secret information. Yeah, don't tell them. Yeah, no, the, are we on? Okay, yeah, so the point of what I was saying, that you're not getting the whole thing, is that the instructions about serenity are found in the Pali scriptures, the Tibet, the Sanskrit tradition, and it's taught in the Theravada, Chinese, Tibetan traditions. So it's, yeah, something quite universal. Okay, so we're going to go back to this book. Yeah, Following in the Buddha's Footsteps. We're on page 179. We finished the section before that. That was Taming the Five Hindrances. Yeah. And, you know, the first part of that gave specific antidotes for specific afflictions that interrupt, you know, interrupt our meditation. So it's important to know those, and also important to apply them. Yeah. So everybody's, you know, thinks, oh, concentration, I want to learn how to concentrate. And okay, I'll just sit there and stare at a candle. You know, no, that's not the way to develop concentration. It is the way to develop eye strain, okay? But it's not the way to develop concentration, okay? So we really have to learn from the pros about how to do this and not just think, okay, I sit down and close my eyes and yeah, I can concentrate. Yeah, you can concentrate on pizza, on sex, on what you have to do tomorrow, what you did yesterday, on what somebody said to you 10 years ago and you're still mad about it. Lots of concentration on those things. Is that the higher training in concentration that the Buddha teaches us how to do? No. We know that one all by ourselves, don't we? Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the visualizing the mirror field, doing the chanting. And so remember, when we're visualizing the mirror field, we're surrounded by all sentient beings, and the people that we don't get along with are, we imagine, are right in front of us, also looking at the three jewels. And so we have to see them. We have to make peace with them in order to, for us to see the three jewels. Otherwise, our anger is a big obscuration. Let's cultivate our motivation. So since it's said that developing serenity and then the higher meditative absorptions is extremely peaceful and blissful, there's a danger that we want to listen to the instructions on how to generate it with a very self-centered motivation. We want the peace, we want the bliss, but that's not appropriate for people who aspire to the bodhisattva path. So it's very important to see the generation of concentration in the big picture, how it is a skill that will enable us to deepen our renunciation of samsara, to generate bodhicitta that is stable, that doesn't fluctuate, and to generate wisdom and be able to focus on the nature of reality, the emptiness of inherent existence without getting distracted, so that we can actually eliminate the afflictions altogether. And so we're doing this with the motivation of bodhicitta, seeing it for the long-term benefit of all living beings. Okay, so just a short review of the previous section on taming the five hindrances. So the main points, how to do it, pay attention to virtuous objects, and precisely contemplate the opposite of the distracting thought or emotion. In other words, the antidote that's taught in Lamrim or in thought training. Okay, the second one, and all of these have sub-branches, so I'm just going over the major outline. The second one is examine the danger and disadvantages of those distracting thoughts. Yeah, how they make you miserable now and get your mind stuck and ruminating about something over and over and over again and driving yourself crazy. Yeah, I see a lot of nodding heads, you know what I'm talking about. You get stuck on something, and oh boy. Okay, so to see those disadvantages for this life, and then the impediments that it makes to our overall spiritual progress. Okay, and then third is don't give attention to those thoughts, ignore them. Yeah, so there, I don't know, maybe some people can ignore them. Maybe after you've practiced a while with the antidotes and you know the antidotes quite well, then when that affliction arises, you can ignore it. Yeah. But I know for myself, you know, when my mind is stuck on something and I keep thinking about it again and again, telling myself to ignore it doesn't work. I have to first understand how I am misperceiving the object, how that is an erroneous consciousness. Because as long as I think my idea is correct, as long as I believe my emotion is the only one any sane person would feel, as long as I, you know, believe that, then I can't ignore it, because in my mind it's true. Yeah. So I've got to understand first how, you know, yes, it may seem true to my worldly mind, but if I look at it, this situation from the viewpoint of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, they would see the situation completely different than the way I would. Okay. So maybe I'm getting super sensitive because somebody criticized me, and I'm going around and around, and why are they criticizing me? I'm always the one who's picked on. They're blaming me for things I didn't do. How come nobody understands me? You know what I'm talking about. Everybody feels that way, huh? This is unfair. It's unjust. Other people have it better than me. I'm persecuted. Yeah. Okay. So as long as you really are stuck in that kind of thought, you can't, at least I couldn't just ignore it, because I really believe those thoughts. Yeah, that's the truth of the situation. Yeah. Of course, if I ask somebody else, do they agree with it? Yeah. If they agree with it, then that person is my friend. If they don't agree with it, then they're going the enemy bucket, and I'm going to ruminate about how I can't trust them either. Just like everybody else, nobody treats me fairly, including that person who doesn't understand me. So I know for myself, I need to prove to myself that the way I'm looking at the situation is dumb, you know, and that I'm just projecting stuff on it that I really have no valid information about. Okay. Well, I do have valid information because I can read their mind. I know their motivation. Yeah. Yeah, really? And I not only know their motivation, is I can psychoanalyze them and give them a label. Yeah. Yeah, they're picking on me. Okay, they must be narcissistic. Yeah, that is that the right diagnosis? Narcissistic. Yeah, but sometimes they're nice to me, and other times they blame me. So that's what's that? Bipolar. Okay, so they're bipolar. Yeah, and schizophrenic. Sometimes what they accuse me of is really stupid, but I still get mad. So they must be schizophrenic. Oh, our therapist looks really disappointed at me. I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, everybody diagnoses everybody else. So, yeah. Really, I mean, I've noticed that with people that, you know, everybody has, can give everybody else a diagnosis. Yeah. Okay. So my point is, you know, until I start to practice one of these antidotes and start switching my frame of reference and looking at the situation from a different perspective, it's only then that I start to see, oh, my take on it is not correct. There's something else going on here. Okay, so the example, I'm sitting there, supposed to be meditating, developing concentration on the figure of the Buddha, or maybe I'm doing the four mindfulnesses of the body, and so I'm developing concentration on that whole pile of bones, you know. And yeah, and I just got distracted by somebody remembering that in the break time, somebody didn't like my idea. So if somebody doesn't like my idea, that means they don't respect me. Right? Yeah. And it also means they're out to get me. Yeah, because they contradicted me right to my face. Can you imagine? Yeah. So I'm mad. Okay, now, if I, as long as I'm looking at that from the perspective of this life and my mind covered with afflictions, that looks true. If I look at that from the perspective of multiple lives, then I have to ask myself, why am I experiencing this situation? Oh, karma. It has something to do with karma. It has something to do with things that I said or did or thought in a previous life that I just ran with, you know? And I was, maybe previous life, I was the one who was mad at somebody else, not necessarily that person in their previous life. It could have been anybody or anything, and I was mad, and I took it out on them, and I swore, and I, you know, threw a stuffed animal at them, and, you know, that's as violent as I get, you know, but, you know, and maybe that's what I did. Yeah, I can imagine myself getting really mad and telling somebody off in a previous life. And like, oh, you know, sometimes I've even done that this life. Yeah. But, you know, what's karma? If I did that in the past, yeah, then it's coming back to me. why am I so surprised? Yeah, if I gave that same kind of behavior out to somebody else in the past, why am I surprised that somebody is treating me that way now? Yeah, so what is the, you know, the real culprit? It's not the other person. The real culprit is my own defiled actions that I did. Yeah, and so me blaming the other person, pointing the finger at the other person, you know, then that's really not accurate in the situation. They may have been the cooperative condition, but if I hadn't created the principal condition with my own previous negative action, then this would not be happening to me. Okay, so is there a reason for me to be mad? No. Okay, drop it. Now go back to the meditation object. Yeah? So you do it in that way. So, you know, my point was I had to see how, from looking at this situation in another way, how my worldly take on it is skewed and not correct. Yeah? And, you know, that's really important, because otherwise, if you say, oh, you just say, oh, I'm angry, what's an antidote? And then you're not really first seeing why that thought is defective, why it's inaccurate, yeah. Or it says, ignore it, yeah. I'm so mad, ignore it. Ignore it. You know, that's the way it is, isn't it? Okay. So I find, you know, there's so many antidotes, you know, and Buddha explains them, Shantideva explains them. I find for many situations, thinking about karma, very, very effective, you know. For situations where I'm unhappy about something, where I feel like I'm not being treated fairly or respected or appreciated or loved enough, or to, you know, then if I just look at, you know, oh, what could I have done in a previous life? There's always something. Yeah. Because, I do many of those same things in this life. So something similar to that in a previous life, yep. Even something worse in a previous life. Maybe in a previous life, my anger was even worse. And I was, you know, a gangster and I shot somebody because they didn't like my idea. Who knows? You know, it's hard to think of yourself as being some other person like that. But I find it very helpful. Yeah. Because otherwise I'm not really facing what my afflictions could have done. And also because they say we've been everything, done everything in samsara. You have a question?
Venerable, I see one end of the mind that goes this way, like you were saying, and then the other end that goes, everything is my fault because my karma. Then you go down that road of, oh, it's my fault, I created this. And
yeah, I'm such a miserable person, I can't do anything right. No wonder they don't like me.
Yeah, because I created that karma. So yeah. How do you switch that?
Well, you realize that what blaming yourself is, you know, that's just another affliction. Yeah, anger at others, anger at yourself, guilt, you know, it's just another way of making ourselves the most important one in the universe. Isn't it? Oh, my negative karma, I must have done this horrible thing in a previous life. I'm such a bad person. Oh, you know, no wonder when I do all this purification, nothing clears up because I just have so much negative karma because all I've done in a previous life is been gangsters and robbers and presidents of countries who have mistreated the people and been corrupt. And, you know, I've done all of that. And what a horrible person I am. Isn't that grasping at a truly existent I? Isn't that grasping at a permanent person? Yeah. Is that a correct? No, it's not a correct cognition. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So throw it away. Yeah.
I really like the idea of using karma as an antidote because it also helps you, the way you're describing it, shift your worldview over and over again, which it, you know, it really, I wasn't raised to think that way or to even believe in it. So any help I can get to keep it fresh and apply it. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah, that's very true. It really helps us remember to have the Buddhist worldview that it's not just this life and it's not just now what's happening, to have a big picture. Things arise due to causes and conditions. Causes come from the past, don't they? Causes do not happen at the same time as the result. So if I believe that things come because of causes, the causes were in the past, okay? And then you start thinking of past lives, yeah? Okay, then, so that was the third one. We're just on the review. Then the fourth is examine the formation of those thoughts. For example, ask yourself, why am I thinking this? What are the factors leading me to think like this? Okay, so why am I thinking this? Oh, well, I'm remembering something that happened yesterday. Yeah, that was a factor. Something happened yesterday. That's a factor. And I'm remembering that, you know, and that's why I'm thinking about this right now. Okay. Is the way I'm, you know, why is this thought disturbing me? It's something that happened in the past. It is not happening right now. Yeah, whatever that terrible, horrible thing somebody said to me was, they're not saying it right now. I'm not in any danger right now. Yeah, why do I believe? Well, why am I angry because somebody said that? Well, it might be true. Well, if it's true, then I better look at it and acknowledge my fault. Well, but it's not true. Well, if it's not true, why am I upset about it? Yeah, what they're saying isn't accurate. Why do I need to get mad at it? And then, well, why do I keep coming back to it? Well, I'll give you a secret hint. It's because of the self-centered thought, that things, that everything that happens to me, every little thing, is the most important thing in the universe. Yeah, when you ruminate, when you go over that, they said this and then they did this and they're always doing this and it's no fair and oh no. Why am I dwelling on this? Because it makes me feel like I exist. Yeah? I mean, I'd much rather have a happy thought that made me feel like I exist, but I don't. But the most important thing is that I exist. And if I'm mad, I'm exist. I exist. If I'm offended, if people are not treating me properly, if I'm unappreciated, I exist. You know? And when you really look at it deeply, so many things come back to that self-grasping ignorance that feels threatened, you know? And yes, praise helps me feel I exist, but so does blame. Yeah? Now, is that wisdom? No. Is that a valid cognizer? No. Okay. It's a stupidaggio. So, yeah, put it in the garbage with all of our other stupidaggios. Yeah, we're supposed to collect wisdom and method, and we collect stupidaggio. Okay. Okay, and then the last one was crush the mind with mind. In other words, really focus on the virtuous mental state. Yeah. Okay, so now we're on to the next section, which is called Meditating on the Body to Counteract Desire. Okay, so the word desire has two different meanings, yeah, or two different connotations, I should say. Both of them have the implication of wanting something, okay? The desire that wants material objects, that wants fame, that wants pleasure, that wants all the things you weren't getting that were the reason why you got mad. Yeah. All those things are the wrong kind of desire. They're the afflicted desire. Yeah. Because they're all based on ignorance and, you know, and they're not, they're leading us down a rabbit hole of a lot of disillusionment, disappointment, and everything else. We don't, that's the kind of desire we don't want. Yeah. But then people say, oh, but what about if I desire awakening or I desire to be a kind of person? Isn't that attachment too? Shouldn't I abandon that? The answer is no. Okay. Because, you know, desire is just the mind going, wanting to go in the direction of something. Those are virtuous desires. Yeah. So sometimes instead of calling the virtuous ones a desire, we call them aspirations. Yeah. Or we just say a virtuous desire. I remember once, there's one prayer to Chenrezig, or a couple of prayers where they talk about Chenrezig being attached to sentient beings. Do you remember that? Yeah, that Chenrezig is just attached to sentient beings. And then I remember the first time I read that, it's like, well, that's a defilement. How can Chenrezig have the one of the biggest defilements in the world, you know? And what it is sometimes how they word it is they use that word, but it doesn't mean the usual attachment, because the usual attachment is based on exaggerating the good qualities of someone or something, and the kind of quote, quote, attachment Chenrezig has is based on accurately perceiving the person. Yeah, or all, accurately perceiving all those sentient beings and seeing them as beings who are overpowered by ignorance, anger, and attachment, and so have a lot of dukkha and don't even know how to get out of their situation. Okay. So don't, if yeah, keep, remember this when you read the words, yeah. So, okay, so meditating on the body to counteract desire. Here, the kind of desire we want to counteract, which kind is it?
Afflicted. Sexual desire.
Yeah, it's sexual desire. Is it virtuous or non-virtuous? Non-virtuous. Okay. Is it going to bring you ultimate happiness?
No.
Lama Yeshe one time was talking about it. He said, it seems like it's going to bring you ultimate happiness, but if it did, why do you have to keep doing it? You know? If it brought you ultimate happiness when you did it, then that happiness should never fade. Yeah? Oh, you know, Lama has a point. Okay. But this meditation isn't just to counteract desire. It's also a way to develop concentration. Yeah. So it performs both functions. Okay. So the meditations on the body found in the treasury of knowledge are presented as antidotes to the sensual desire that interferes with concentration. So here the presentation is from Abhidharma, okay, from Vasubandhu. When we talk about the four, in the four establishments of mindfulness, yeah, it's not just to counteract desire, but it's to gain wisdom, because that mindfulness is put together with the mental factor of wisdom. Okay, so presented according to Vasubandhu, treasury of knowledge. They can also be done as practices of mindfulness of the body that they aid in the cultivation of wisdom. Okay, so that's in the four establishments of mindfulness. These meditations on the body may initially appear off-putting, but this is precisely why they work to counteract sexual desire. If they weren't off-putting, they wouldn't do their job. Okay. I was teaching in Singapore once to a group of university students, and one person, you know, said, how do I calm my desire? So I taught, not Vasubandhu's one exactly, but, you know, something similar. And they went away and did it and came back the next week. And one boy said, I did it, but now I'm not attracted to my girlfriend anymore. He was really worried, you know. It was like, it worked. Was it supposed to work that way? I said, yes. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, so they may initially appear off-putting, but this is why they work. Okay, perhaps the resistance we have to these meditations isn't that we aren't yet ready to give up enjoyable sensual pleasures. Okay, that's where the resistance is coming from. One time I was asked to teach about the four establishments of mindfulness at Maitripa. Yeah, it was a Saturday event, so there were more than one talk. So, you know, you start out with mindfulness of the body. Well, so I taught that the first session. Then the second session, I said, are there questions? Whoa! You know, they were like, Why do we have to do this? This is, you know, making me feel guilty about my body. How is this a Buddhist practice that's supposed to lead to happiness? They were very upset, you know. More than one person, many people in the audience. Yeah. And why? Because it was hitting at an object of attachment that they weren't yet ready to give up. Yeah. So, yeah. So if you see that in yourself, you know, then just check up. Why don't I want to give this up? Has it brought me ultimate happiness yet? Yeah. Took off my t-shirt. You know, no purpose. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so actually one friend, when, you know, was asking me about this and, you know, talking about the body as foul, and they really didn't like describing it as foul, you know. If the body's foul, you know, I think this is kind of, is this kind of veering into Catholicism in some way? Your body is sinful, right? Catholics, ex-Catholics, yeah, your body is sinful. So, you know, saying the body is foul, it's like you go back to, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, oh, that makes me hate my body. And, you know, it's just like, why do I have to hate my body? It's not about hating your body. Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at the people who do ascetic practices, you have to really check the motivation, you know. I know in Catholicism, maybe not now, but a few decades ago, you know, going and swimming in ice water, not just a quick dip, but staying in it, self-flagellation, these kinds of things to beat the desire out of yourself. Yeah. And so people instantly going back to that. Yeah. Oh, I have to hate my body, beat my body, torture myself. I can't enjoy anything. And so they don't like the word foul. Yeah. They prefer something like unattractive. But, you know, to me, unattractive doesn't really do the trick. Yeah, it's more than unattractive. It is putrid. Yeah, it's putrid. And this, if you do this meditation, it'll show you why. Yeah. Oh, you don't look happy at me saying it's putrid. Oh, yeah, you want body is beautiful, huh? Yeah. Don't want to counteract the desire. So to do these meditations on the body, examine what the body is, both now when it is alive and later when it has become a corpse and is in various states of decay. Yeah. But, you know, we don't see bodies in states of decay, do we? Yeah. Because, you know, at the mortuary, they either they bury them immediately, or they what's it called? Embalm them, yeah. And when they embalm them, they look so peaceful, don't they? Yeah. And they shine a light on it that makes the skin look kind of fresh and pink, you know, if it's a white person. And their eyes are closed. They look like they're sleeping. Yeah, when I was a kid, I remember asking, you know, what does it mean to die? Well, you go to sleep for a long time. Yeah. But this is saying, no, look at the body. Yeah, if it's not embalmed and it's just au natural, you know, like natural food, then, you know, what is it? Okay. When dissecting sexual attachment, see that it arises in relationship to the body's color, shape, tactile contact, and usefulness. Okay, so to counteract attachment to the beautiful color of someone's body, the color of their skin, their eyes that are like diamond, their teeth that are white like pearls from using the right toothpaste, and so forth. Okay, you're looking at the beautiful color. Contemplate that no matter how beautiful his or her body is now, after death, it will not be good looking in the least. Yeah. So if you're there when somebody dies and you can, you know, just be there for the death process and you see how they're trying to keep breathing, you hear the death rattle, and it's clear that they're going. Yeah, is it the body, your friend? Is it so beautiful and attractive? Okay. And as it starts to turn blue, you know, or whatever color it turns. Yeah. So imagine it as a corpse. First, it will turn a dark bluish color. Yeah, not a bright blue, pretty blue. Yeah, not a royal blue, a dark bluish color. Yeah. That will start to go along with the smell. It doesn't mention smell here. Yeah. Color, shape, tactile contact, and usefulness. But smell too. Okay. As it decays further, it will become reddish. And finally, it will become a rotten black corpse. When the person is alive, the color of their body may turn ugly. For example, when bruised or scarred, open sores, boils, and infected areas are likewise unpleasant to look at. So even while the body is alive, there are certain parts, you know, when it's injured or whatever, somebody breaks, you know, their arm or their leg and the bone is sticking out of the skin. Yeah. Or yeah, their head is bleeding, or yeah, whatever. So it can be ugly when it's alive, but especially as it starts, it, you know, because the body is basically meat. Yeah, if you put you know, a piece of steak out there in the sun and just, or anywhere except the freezer, after a while, it's going to turn color and it's going to stink and it's going to decay. And our body is just meat, basically. Yeah. As an antidote to attachment to the, really imagining, you know, if you're attracted to somebody, imagine what they're going to look like when they're dead. Yeah. And imagine what your body is going to look like when it's dead. It's not just their body, but it's our body also that's foul. Yeah. So you have to do it with both, because otherwise, oh yeah, their body's real foul, but I'm hip and I'm attractive, and you know, that's never going to happen to me. Okay, as an antidote to attachment to the attractive shape of another's body. Oh, like, what is it? You know, Jeff, what's his, Bezos, Jeff Bezos? You know, he just got married, so he booked the city of Venice, Italy, for the wedding, basically, and invited over 200 people, and they took over the city, and many of the Venetians were not happy about this. Yeah, but he's marrying one lady, I forget her name. Anyway, yeah, she looked like a Barbie doll in terms of her figure, okay? She, you know, somebody put in a thing of, you know, she's adopted the corset. Yeah, you know what they used to, you remember Scarlett O'Hara in the movie Gone with the Wind? You know, your waist is like about this big. Yeah, your bust is, you know, out here. Yeah, and that's how she, and then her clothes, Jeff Bezos' wife, skin tight. Yeah. Why anybody would want to look like that and attract that kind of attention that it's going to attract? Well, I guess, well, okay, when I was younger, I wanted that, you know, to be looked at that way, but I don't want people to look at me that way now. Get it, okay? Yeah, I mean, that's why our robes are loose and baggy, aren't they? Okay, so as an antidote to attachment to the attractive shape of another's body, contemplate its appearance when it is a bloated and swollen corpse. Okay, so this woman who was so proud to have, you know, look emaciated like Barbie. Yeah, this is what her body's gonna look like, yeah, when she dies, if she maintains the same weight. But we all know that as you get older, you don't maintain the same weight, and where your fat changes. Yeah, and for women, your fat goes from here to your belly, yeah. As you age. Yeah. Okay. I think for men it does too. Men tend to develop pot bellies. Yeah. You get the feeling like they need a wheelbarrow to carry their belly because it's so big. But it is. When it dies, it is a bloated, swollen corpse. Okay. Larger animals and birds eat the flesh and then tear the body apart to gnaw on the bones, destroying its beautiful shape. Even when a person is alive, the shape of their body may be disfigured due to illness or injury. Yeah? I mean, how many people in Ukraine are missing limbs now? Yeah. Civilians, I'm not even talking about the soldiers, but civilians. Okay, so the body is misshapen. To counteract attachment to the touch of their body, imagine it as being a corpse being devoured by maggots and other insects. Just the idea of touching it quickly fades away. So it's a decaying corpse. Yeah. And the skin has been broken. The, you know, yeah. At Copan, there was one dog. Wow. This dog was in bad shape, you know, with her limp. She was limping around because her back legs didn't work. And then she had a litter of puppies. How she did that, I don't know. But then as she got old, there were maggots and everything in her skin. So if you've ever seen that in an animal, you know, then you think of that, that's for a human being as well, if the body's just left out there. Yeah, worms. Maggot sounds too polite. Worms. Worms crawling around in the flesh, eating it. And flies and bees and all sorts of insects around, eating it, taking the moisture from it. Do you want to touch that body? It's kind of gooey. And, you know, it might be moist with blood, or maybe the blood is coagulated by now. Okay. So, you know, this could, I think when the Tibetans in Old Tibet had the habit of when somebody died, they would take the body to the top of a mountain. And there were certain people, their job was to cut it up in pieces and leave it out, and the vultures would come and eat it. Yeah. And I remember seeing a video of this, you know, with the vultures all flying there and going to eat the bodies. Okay. To counteract attachment to the touch of their body, yeah, just imagine it as a corpse being devoured by maggots and other insects. Just the idea of putting your nice, pretty little paws in that gooey, stinky mess. Yeah. Okay. Eventually, the flesh is consumed, revealing the skeleton. This is hardly a body we want to embrace. Yeah. Do you want to hug and kiss a skeleton? And I'm not talking about bony. You know, bony is, you know, all clean and he's dressed properly and, you know, bony looks kosher. But, you know, a regular decaying body is not that neat. And, you know, especially if the animals are eating it, they're going to pull the limbs apart, you know, grab part of an internal organ and take it away, you know, and eat it over there, and they'll fight over it. Okay. Yeah, so when alive, the body may be covered with open sores infested with worms. Here in India, we see lepers whose flesh has rotten and fallen off, revealing the bone underneath. And if you have been to India, you see this often in the train stations. In McLeod Ganj, we had the lepers that lived there. The usefulness, this is the next aspect. The usefulness of another's body refers to the pleasure derived from it. So how you can use somebody else's body. This may be sexual pleasure or pleasure because they serve us. They cook your food, they say nice things, they run errands for you. Or pleasure from their personality. Yeah, they have a good sense of humor, they say things that really make you think a lot, whatever it is, okay? So that's use all those ways in which we can appreciate a living person, which means that their body is useful because that's the basis of their life. Okay. Here we consider that person almost like an instrument for our own use, enjoyment, and pleasure. Yeah. Lama Yeshe also had a good one about this. Yeah. He said, when you say I love you, it really means I want to use you. Think about that one. Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't use somebody. I really cared for them. I want the best for them. I wouldn't use them. Well, I'm using them for my amusement, for my emotional support. Yeah, because they say nice things about me and they help me when I'm down, and yeah, I'm not using them. Well, if they were angry at you, then what? Would you still feel the same way? No, why not? If you really cared about them, the essence of who they are, then why don't you care about them? Why are you getting divorced? You know, why don't you care about them when they're angry? And when they're old and you know, smelly? Or they're sick in the hospital and, huh? Yeah, we should, if we really cared for them, the essence of them. Of course, there is no essence of them, but we can invent one and hallucinate one. Okay. So here we consider that person almost like an instrument for our own use, enjoyment, and pleasure. As an antidote, meditate on an unmoving corpse or cadaver. It lacks a personality and cannot do anything for us. It's not going to run errands. Are you going to want to kiss and hug and have sex with that? Some monk in the Vinaya did. Yeah, that doesn't mean you have to. Yeah. No, it's shocking in the Vinaya, some of the things they did. Yeah. The poor Buddha, he had to, you know, all these people, and not just pedophiles, but animophiles. Yeah. Having sex with a monkey or a donkey or. Okay. So the point is, yeah, that when they die, their body is of no use to us. So, and clearly that body no longer has a consciousness. So it doesn't have a good sense of humor. It's not going to cheer us up when we're down. Okay. As an antidote to all four, color, shape, touch, and usefulness, beginning at the person's forehead or at their toes, visualize the person's flesh rotting and falling off piece by piece. Okay, so this is your meditation, what you're imagining, you know, that really good looking body, and it is rotting and falling, the flesh is falling off piece by piece, stinky, dirty, disgusting looking, until only a skeleton remains. And that skeleton is not polished, like bony and clean. You know, it's like what if you've ever eaten meat, yeah, and they serve you something with bones, and you are basically eating the flesh of that animal. Do you get every single scrap off the bones? No, there's little pieces left on, you know, parts of sinews and tendons, and, you know, it's not polished and clean and nice and neat. Okay. So then imagine the same thing happening. So you do that with your body or the person's flesh, yeah. Then the other person. Then imagine the same thing happening to others' bodies until the whole universe is entirely filled with bones. Yeah, so you can, you know, start with one person here at the Abbey, and by the end of the meditation, in your mind, everybody's body has, you know, the flesh has fallen off and there's just bones, dirty, you know. I mean, I think people who have cooked meat, maybe the women understand this better, because you've been in the position of being in a kitchen with your mother when they, you know, were doing this and seeing what it looked like. Okay. Until the entire universe is filled with bones. Alternatively, meditate on the components of the body, the intestines, stomach, muscles, kidneys, spleen, brain, blood, and so on. Whether the body is alive or dead, the color, shape, and touch of its organs are unpleasant. Some people faint when seeing the inside of the body. So when I was in Thailand, you know, because they have the custom in the U.S., you know, going to see an autopsy, I don't know how legal that is. Probably you'd have to jump through some hoops. But in Thailand, because the monks do it for their practice, it's easy to do that. So when I was staying there at Wat Mop John, they offered to take us to see an autopsy. And I had, in college, taken an anatomy class. I had, you know, dissected a cadaver. But a cadaver is a little bit different, you know, because, I mean, it's the color is brown, and but it doesn't smell often, and awful, and it's been dissected many times, so it's been put back together, everything in its right place, you know. Anyway. But actually going when they are cutting the body open at a real, I was going to say a real live. yeah, you know, it's a different thing. So it was interesting because it was me and Wee Ling, one of Singaporean woman, and then a few monks going. And when we were driving there, the monks were so concerned. You know, you're gonna see a body getting cut up, and you know, do you think you're gonna faint? If you're gonna faint, you know, just leave the room. Don't make yourself stay there. In fact, if the whole idea repulses you of going, you can just wait outside for us. They were so concerned about the two of us fainting. Yeah, so Wee Ling says, you know, we've all been in the kitchen with our mothers, cutting up animals, you know, chickens and pieces of, you know, animals. She said, we're not gonna faint. You know, we've seen that kind of stuff. Yeah, and the reason they were asking us is because one of the younger monks had fainted at the last time they went. Yeah, so they're so worried about us. And Wee Ling was like, forget it, you know?
So I don't really have the cultural experience of chopping up an animal in the kitchen with my mom. And I think it's an interesting thing to think about that here at the Abbey, you know, walking on the trail, I've seen dead animals mm-hmm. in various states of decay. Mm-hmm. When before in the city or the suburbs, it's like, well, maybe I drive by some roadkill, but I'm going very fast. I don't really see, you know, at the grocery store growing up again in the suburbs, it's like, you know, your chicken breast is just nicely cleaned and, you know, chlorinated or whatever for it to keep its color. You know, you don't have to dissect it yourself, opposed to people who are growing up in cultures where you go to a market and are picking out the chicken you want, or if you're growing up on a farm and, you know, killing the chicken. So there's a generational thing, a cultural thing.
It depends on the country, because like you said, in America, in the West, grocery stores are very sanitized. You know, so you can buy meat, but you don't connect it that this is the flesh of a living being. It's just meat, you know, and everybody eats meat, so you buy, but you don't think, yeah. But when you go to many other countries in the world, yeah, when you were in India and you go to the bazaar in India, you will see, you know, a skinned cow hanging from its legs tied up and they're upside down like this. Even in Singapore, remember one shop that was near the subway that we walked by, and they had chickens every day,
ducks.
You know?
Yeah, ducks.
Huh?
Ducks.
Ducks? Yeah. Yeah, hanging, you know, by their feet, upside down, skinned. Yeah, we don't see that here. The whole body, just but without the skin, without the head. Yeah. I mean, you can go to the store and get chicken livers, but you don't imagine what a chicken looks like when they're taking out the chicken livers. Yeah, so there's a disconnect in our culture. Yeah, we buy meat, but it's not living beings' bodies. It's not corpses. Well, it is a corpse. Okay. Contemplate your own body in a similar way. For one day, it will be a rotting corpse, or just a pile of ashes if cremated. Meditating on the body as described above causes the mind to become disillusioned with the splendors of samsara. Like, you know, why do we want to embrace somebody else's body? And why do we ourselves want to take another body? Yeah. It is less distracted by sensual desire and can more easily be applied to concentration. Yeah. Okay. Now, the next part of meditating on the body, meditating on a skeleton to counteract restlessness. So this meditation is really good. And when I was having a few of the sessions with His Holiness, you know, about these books, I was asking him to teach, you know, the four establishments of mindfulness. And so he went through this meditation and I started doing it. It was really interesting. My mind got very calm. Yeah, got very calm. And it was easy to, it was strangely easy to contemplate. Yeah, but let me describe the meditation. Okay. Meditating on your own body as a skeleton makes the mind sober and is a general antidote for restlessness. So restlessness, your mind is going from this object to that object, and you want to stand up and check your email because you're sure that, you know, the president just emailed you, or you just won a lottery. You know, that's your junk mail. Sorry. you know, distracted. I want to go do this. I have to do that. Okay. So the following meditations on a skeleton may work also to eliminate laxity, because the mind focuses on an object that becomes more and more subtle. Okay, so it is an antidote to restlessness, flighty mind, yeah. And, you know, when your mind, the clarity of your mind, or the intensity of the clarity isn't so good, because here, as you'll see as we do it, the bones that you're concentrating on get smaller and smaller. Okay, so begin the meditation by focusing on your mid-brow, Okay. And visualize the flesh gradually falling off. Yeah, so you have to do it slowly, you know. It's not like boom and all of that. But yeah, that if you do it like that, it doesn't have the same effect. So you concentrate here, and then you imagine that your flesh is falling off, you know, up here, everywhere, you know, big pieces falling off. Yeah. Yeah, until, and you do that starting here and going all the way down gradually, everything, the outside, everything falling off, the muscles falling off, the inner organs falling away, yeah, until only your skeleton remains. Okay, then, so you're focusing on you're sitting there, you know, and there's just a skeleton sitting there. And then that skeleton grows in size and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and more bones appear until all of space is filled with bones. Okay, so this is a meditation that yogis do to develop concentration. Yeah, and to develop renunciation. Yeah, so you start here, everything falls away, everything just blah, you know, goes away. There's your body, okay. Mine still is gonna have a piece of metal where my right hip is. Yeah, do you have metal in your shoulder? She's very well decorated with medals. Yeah. So, yeah. But there it is. Yeah. And then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it starts emanating more bones until your whole, everywhere you look, yeah, is bones. Yeah. And so inside, you know, don't think, oh, well, I'm hollow and white and pure. My bones are white and clean and everything. Yeah, everybody's bones around are white and clean. But you just, every space is filled with skeletons or just random bones, you know. So concentrate on that for a while. And then imagine the bones absorbing one into another until only the room is filled with bones. So because you have now bones in infinite space, they start to absorb. And until only this room, yeah, how many bones could you fit in this room? How many skeletons if you squeeze them all in? You know, until only this room was filled with bones. And you concentrate on that for a while. Okay. Then the bones absorb further until it's only your skeleton that's there. And you focus on that. Meditate single pointedly on this. So this is the yoga for beginners. Yeah, the flesh falls off. You're a skeleton, it grows bigger, the universe is filled with bones, then the bones start absorbing into, you know, so smaller spaces until there's only your bone, your skeleton. And that you focus on. Okay, once you are able to do the above meditation well, you can move on to the second level, the yoga of thorough training. The process of visualization is similar, beginning by focusing on a small piece of exposed bone at your mid-brow. Yeah, so like right here, all the flesh comes out. Yeah, there you are, but there's a hole in your flesh and the bone showing. Okay, so focusing on a small piece of exposed bone at your midbrow and imagining the flesh falling away from the rest of your body until only your skeleton remains. So again, like that, everything falling away just to your own skeleton. Then that expands, filling the entire room with bones, big bones, small bones, just lots of bones everywhere. Yeah, it expands more. Yeah, so that the whole environment is brimming with bones everywhere you can see. More bones appear until the whole environment is brimming with bones. Then, as you focus on that for a little bit, then narrow the scope of the visualization as before, with the bones gradually absorbing one into the other, until only your skeleton remains. Then your skeleton dissolves from the bottom up. All those bones just dissolve into nothingness from the bottom up, you know, through here, your thighs, your pelvis, your rib cage, you know, your spine, into your head, yeah, until only the upper part of your skull remains. So when you get to the head, then, you know, all that bone dissolves too, so that then all you're visualizing is the bone that is the upper part of your skull. Okay. Concentrate on this, fine-tuning the focus of your meditation in this way. Yeah. And so that's for your concentration. Yeah. At the end of these meditations with the skeleton, you can imagine that your flesh and organs and everything is reappearing. But I found when I did that, you know, thinking like there was something quite clean about the skeleton. And when I started thinking of the muscles appearing and, you know, liver and intestine and, you know, kidneys and bladder and bile and, you know, all this stuff, then it was just, you know, because you have to, yeah, put your body together like it was before. Then this feeling of like yuck came, you know, really yucky. Okay, so that's the second level. In the third level, the yoga of complete attention, visualize in the same way as before, expanding the range of the bones, and then withdrawing and absorbing them until only the upper half of the skull remains. Okay, so just like the second part, yeah. Then that dissolves, your whole top of your skull dissolves until only a tiny fragment of bone is there at your midbrow. And you concentrate on that single pointedly. Just a little piece of bone. Okay, and then again, when you enter meditation, everything reappears. So this meditation brings many advantages. First, meditating on the foul aspects of the body subdues attachment and restlessness, which fantasizes about the pleasures we crave. The mind settles and our attention no longer scatters to objects of attachment. Okay, this benefits of this meditation. Second, by making our observed objects smaller, subtler and subtler, first the skeleton, then the upper half of the skull, and finally only that tiny bone fragment. We also counteract laxity by increasing the intensity of the clarity of our visualization. Yeah. These two bring the third advantage, the ability to concentrate single-pointedly on the chosen object of meditation. Yeah. So when the object of meditation is very small like that, it increases the intensity of the clarity and helps the stability as well. The above meditations on foulness act as antidotes to attachment and restlessness. Although they do not eliminate the seeds of these afflictions from our mind streams, they reduce their coarse level by preventing their manifesting in our minds. Whether an object is actually attractive or not, our minds are fully capable of fabricating beauty. Okay. One of my friends in Israel was a hospice nurse, some kind of nurse. She wasn't a nurse. Her husband was dying, or was very sick, and so she kept going into the hospital to look after him and to see him. And she would say to the nurse, "Isn't he beautiful?" Yeah. He was an old man, wrinkled, smelly, not very beautiful, but to the wife's eyes, he was beautiful. And my friend was the nurse, and the wife was saying that to her. And she was thinking, "You think that's beautiful?" Yeah, but this is the power of our mind. It can make anything beautiful, even though it's not. Whether an object is actually attractive or not, our minds are fully capable of fabricating beauty. By reflecting that our own and others' bodies ultimately become bones, we see that there is nothing left to desire but the bones, which are not very attractive. If you wonder if these meditations really work to calm attachment, the way to find out is to do them. Yeah. And do them several times, really work on it. I was gonna say chew on the meditation. Yeah. But it's interesting, you know, if you used to eat meat, I mean, people eat meat, you chew on the bone, don't you? But if you said to somebody, you know, to dissect it and then chew on the bone, it just seems like disgusting. But that's basically what you do when you go, you know, to one of these expensive steak places. Yeah. Okay, so questions, comments?
The question is, why is it more advanced to concentrate on a fraction of your skeleton?
On a fraction of your skull, because it's a smaller object. You know, if you concentrate on your head or your body, it's a bigger object. When you can narrow it to something that's small, then it's helps the concentration. But you don't start out meditating on the body with it like that. You have to start out, it's a series of meditations. Okay, uh-huh.
During meditation, some people prefer to do breathing meditation and less analytical meditation. Can you give advice on this, and how long should the concentration session be in a meditation?
It depends on the individual. Yeah, when you're beginning, they say make your session short and sweet, because if you make them too long, then you don't want to come back and meditate again. Yeah, On the other hand, if you, you know, make them too short, then you can't really get into anything. So, you know, it depends on the individual. Mm-hmm.
So are these meditations, like the on the body or the skeleton, when we notice that attachment is coming up and we pause and we meditate on that, or is this just what we would use to actually develop serenity on, or it's just both, depending on, like, are these antidotes that we use just for time being, and then once the affliction subsided, we go back to like the breath or the Buddha, or is this what we're actually developing concentration
on? No, as it's saying, it's helping you to concentrate. It can be your object of meditation. Yeah. Do you remember, you know, when we went through at the beginning, the various objects of meditation? So yeah, it's included in one of those. Yeah. So if you're finding like a lot of attachment and lust and so on coming up, then it's really good to do this regularly and calm your mind. Huh? Anything else? Okay, then we'll dedicate.